loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we talk about UK Prime Minister Theresa May's last-ditch effort to save the Brexit deal she negotiated with the European Union as politics in Britain descend into chaos. And then today, we continue our weekly series. It happens every Tuesday, called False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, President Trump said this morning in a series of tweets that he will call out the military to build a border wall if Democrats in Congress fail to provide the necessary funding for the wall's construction. Democrats, meanwhile, warned that Trump could cause a government shutdown on Friday if the Republican Congress does not approve emergency government funding. Next, Maria Butina, a Russian student and gun rights activist accused of failing to register as a foreign agent, has agreed to plead guilty to one count of conspiracy and to cooperate in ongoing federal, state, and local investigations. Butina is expected to tell a federal court in Washington tomorrow that she was working to establish relationships with American political groups at the direction of an unnamed Russian official. But critics of the Russiagate campaign say that Butina was a victim of strong-arm tactics by the FBI. Then, Google CEO Sundar Pichai testified before the House Judiciary Committee this morning about his company's algorithms and whether they are politically biased, and also about Google's privacy practices. Employees took advantage of the high-profile meeting to raise concerns about the company's harassment and discrimination policies. And then the Supreme Court yesterday declined to review lower court decisions that blocked state efforts to cut off public funding for Planned Parenthood, a move that reveals a split within the court's conservative bloc. And finally, an antitrust lawsuit brought by states over two drugs has exploded into a price-fixing investigation against 16 pharmaceutical companies manufacturing more than 300 drugs. Federal authorities allege that pharma executives fixed prices for generic drugs for years, and the Attorney General of Connecticut is calling it, quote, the largest criminal cartel in the history of the United States, unquote. And in other headlines, Donald Trump met with Democratic congressional leaders Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer this afternoon to talk about government spending. The three then held a remarkable press conference where Trump taunted the Democrats and threatened to shut down the government in order to secure funding for a border wall. Pelosi and Schumer put up mild resistance during the spectacle, with Schumer imploring the president to voice his criticisms of them in private rather than in front of the press. Peace talks in Sweden to resolve the Yemen war made progress today. Negotiators representing the Houthi movement and the government of Abd Rabu Mansour Hadi agreed to a prisoner swap involving 16,000 detained people. The Saudi-led and U.S.-supported war on the country has caused what many call the world's worst current humanitarian crisis. 44 former senators published an open letter in the Washington Post today sharply criticizing the Trump administration, focusing on the Mueller investigation. The signatories claimed that the Senate has, quote, long stood in defense of democracy, unquote, and needs to again in the current situation. The letter was signed by 32 Democrats, 10 Republicans, and 2 independents. The Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees said that it expects up to 250,000 Syrian refugees may return home in 2019. There are 5.6 million Syrian refugees in nearby countries. Syria has been embroiled in civil and regional war since 2011, leaving 500,000 people dead by some estimates. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the UK and the Brexit crisis, which is coming to a head. UK Prime Minister Theresa May traveled to Brussels this morning for talks with German Chancellor Angela Merkel and other European leaders. She has not yet rescheduled the vote on Brexit after postponing it yesterday. Meanwhile, Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn told Parliament that the country is in chaos. We are joined from London by Alexander Makouris. Alexander is the editor-in-chief of The Duran. Welcome back, Alexander.
Delighted to be with you.
Jeremy Corbyn is not being hyperbolic, not exaggerating, when he says The country's in chaos. At least it's in political chaos. What's happened? Why has it happened? Let's get the big picture, and then we want to have you listen to a couple audio clips of Theresa May and Jeremy Corbyn both speaking in Parliament and get your reactions.
It's been like watching a train crash, a slow train crash that you could see coming for weeks and indeed months. The fundamental problem is that Theresa May, as Prime Minister, has never really decided what kind of Brexit she wants. She ran the Brexit negotiations with extreme secrecy, trying to focus on the one issue that seems to matter most for her, which is free movement. She doesn't want immigrants. She doesn't like immigration into Britain. So she came up with a deal which she hadn't really worked out with her colleagues. They didn't like it. Parliament, it was absolutely clear, didn't like it. But then she did something on Tuesday, which was absolutely extraordinary, which is that, of course, as the vote was about to happen, because she was going to lose and lose badly, some people think that she would have lost by a majority of 200 MPs, half the Conservative Parliamentary Party voting against her. She decided to call the vote off. Now, she didn't call the vote off because something new had happened that she'd heard, for example, from the Prime Minister of Ireland that there was going to be a change and he was making some offer and the British government needed time. She called it off because she was about to lose, and if she had lost a vote on that scale, she would have had to resign. So she called the vote off to save her position as Prime Minister. By doing that, she has in effect discredited herself, antagonized everybody on all sides in the political system, and of course has created a system where no one knows any longer what is going to happen from one day to the other. And this talk about renegotiating the deal that she negotiated, the Europeans are not going to renegotiate with her because she has no credibility left and no authority, and they cannot believe that any deal they negotiate with her is going to stick in Britain. So we have chaos. We have a vacuum of authority. It's not just chaos in the political system. It is now starting to hit the economy as well.
I have to ask you, too, and I think I probably know the answer in advance, but if we cut through the chaff and we ask, so what is going to happen? This thing is going to have to come to a vote. Whether May has the votes or not, it's going to have to come to a vote. As things stand now, the vote will fail. And then what?
Well, indeed. And then what? This is, of course, the great uncertainty. Now, I said that she's did this thing in order to save her position as Prime Minister. There are once again talk within the Conservative Party of replacing her with someone else. We run into the old problem that there's huge uncertainty about who it would be who would take over from her. But let's assume that she clings on, that there is another vote, and that she loses that vote. At that point, she resigns. I don't think there's any question about that. Huge uncertainty still about who takes over. The parliamentary time in order to sort out a further deal on Brexit becomes incredibly short, given that Britain is supposed to leave the European Union on the 29th of March. My best guess is that at that point, we would have some kind of caretaker prime minister put in. He or she would ask the European Union to agree to an extension of the timetable for perhaps 3 months. Britain now, following a European Court of Justice decision, apparently has the right to do that unilaterally anyway, so I think that's what would happen. There would then, I think, be a general election, because whoever became Prime Minister of what was a very weakened government would simply not have the authority to take it forward. That, it seems to me, is the most likely scenario, but it is not a certain one, and anybody who pretends they know for sure what is going to happen over the next few weeks is unfortunately being delusional. I mean, it is very difficult to read the situation now because there is no precedent for it.
That's the voice of Alexander Mercouris. He's talking to us from London. Alexander is the editor-in-chief of the Duran. John, this has been a contentious, well, I don't know, contentious seems like a soft word for what's going on in the UK. We want to play an audio clip of Theresa May. This is from yesterday. She canceled the vote because she was going to lose big time, and that would be the end of her government. Yes. The vote about ratifying this, the terms of the new deal between the UK and the EU, the divorce agreement, basically, mm-hmm. between Britain and the EU. I want people to listen to it because try to pick up some of the ambient noise of what else is going on inside the parliamentary chamber. Then we'll listen to Jeremy Corbyn.
We've now had 3 days of debate on the withdrawal agreement, setting out the terms of our departure from the EU and the political declaration setting out our future relationship after we have left. I've listened very carefully to what has been said in this chamber and out of it.
That's laughter.
To what has been said in this chamber and out of it by members from all sides. From listening to those views, it is clear that while there is broad support for many of the key aspects of the deal, on one issue, the Northern Ireland backstop, there remains widespread and deep concern. As a result, if we went ahead and held the vote tomorrow, the deal would be rejected by a significant margin. We will therefore defer the vote scheduled for tomorrow and not proceed to divide the House at this time.
All right. Fantastic. That's Theresa May. That's the British Parliament. Let's go to a second audio clip because it's Jeremy Corbyn, left-wing leader of the Labour Party, not like the old Labour Party leadership, not like the Blairite wing, the neoliberal capitalist wing of the Labour Party, something very, very different. Let's listen to Jeremy Corbyn's intervention in Parliament.
Mr. Speaker, we've endured 2 years of shambolic negotiations. Yes. Red lines, which have been boldly announced, then cast aside. Yep. We're now on our third Brexit secretary, and it appears each one of them has been excluded from these vital negotiations. We were promised a precise and substantive document and got a vague 26-page wish list. And they become the first government ever in British history to be held in contempt of Parliament. Yes. The government is in disarray.
Government is in disarray. Alexander, really, really something. Go ahead.
Yes, I mean, and what I think those audio clips which you played capture is the dynamic of the House of Commons, because, of course, Theresa May was ridiculed and laughed at by the opposition benches, which, of course, in such an important debate is already a serious matter, but listened to in total silence by her own. You know, cold, icy faces, people sitting with folded arms, whereas, obviously, Jeremy Corbyn, who's had major problems with his party up to now, he was able to move forward. You could hear the cries of support as he forensically demolishes the whole story of the negotiations which have taken place between Theresa May's government and the Europeans over the last 2.5 years. So you can already sense the feel of a government that is disintegrating and the shift within the House of Commons, and indeed within the country in general, between Theresa May's Conservatives and her government, is moving, the pendulum is moving towards Jeremy Corbyn and his leadership of the Labour Party. And, I mean, the other thing that he looked at, he looked fully in command of his party, perhaps for the first time.
Alexander Makouris is our guest. Alexander is the editor-in-chief of the Duran. I'm looking at The Guardian. And here's the headline, Brexit, Merkel, that's the German chancellor, tells May, the British prime minister, deal cannot be renegotiated. That means that as she goes to Berlin and to Brussels and to The Hague to try to find some way out, because she's not going to get this current deal through the British Parliament, which will be the end of the Theresa May government one way or the other. She's going back and they're saying to her, nope, there's not going to be a renegotiation. But, Alexander, as you mentioned, an EU, I believe it was an EU court over the weekend, said if the British want to rethink and not go forward with a Brexit agreement according to the March deadline, they're free to do so. What you are suggesting is that that might go to a general election. I just wondered, do you think it's possible that there could be a second referendum on Brexit? And if there was a second referendum, one, would the vote outcome be different? And two, would the supporters of Brexit sort of be in the streets because they would feel that their vote from the earlier June 2016 had been overturned by fiat?
Well, and may I add to that question before you answer it? Do you think that Britons feel that they were tricked in the first vote, that they were not told the truth about how this would play out?
Right, lots of questions, but let's take it step by step. I think that there is a very real chance of a general election. I think there is a significantly smaller chance at the moment of a second referendum. I would not exclude it entirely. The European Court of Justice decision is quite clear. It makes it absolutely clear that Britain, up to the moment that it leaves the European Union, has the unilateral power to reverse its decision. So that does create the option for a second referendum. There would have to be a second referendum. You can't just cancel the result of the referendum that has happened. If a government comes to power that wants to reverse Brexit. Now, the country remains deeply divided on this issue. There is a very real concern amongst a lot of people that even if Remain succeeded in that vote, and it is absolutely correct that there are some people in Britain who say that, you know, they were deceived into voting in a certain way, but it doesn't seem as if it's a critical mass of them. But let us assume that there was a second referendum and that that second referendum voted to stay in the European Union. There is no doubt at all that a lot of people in Britain would be very angry. They would feel that their vote in the first referendum had been set aside. I don't think it is British culture to actually start rioting and protesting in the way that we have seen in France. But I predict that if that were to happen, we would see a very, very strong swing, probably within the Conservative Party, towards the Conservative Party restructuring itself as the anti-EU party and positioning itself to take Britain out of the EU if it were to win a subsequent general election. In other words, a second referendum would not be the end of this issue. It would simply prolong it even further and divide political opinion in this country even more. So it's not an easy solution, and it's not one that one can be comfortable with.
Alexander, the EU, or the new iteration of European unity, which is the EU now, this whole project started really at the end of World War II. In some ways, it was also not just condoned by, but perhaps even organized or initiated by the United States, which was the sole sort of remaining superpower and after the destruction of the British Empire and the French Empire, so to speak, during the course of World War II. The U.S. reconstructed a new world order. It had the United Nations, it had the IMF, the World Bank, it had vis-a-vis the Bretton Woods Agreement in New Hampshire, the idea that the dollar, the U.S. currency, would become the world currency. There were these different parts to it, and the U.N. said the point of the U.N. was to get rid of the scourge of war, meaning the war between, especially between the major industrial advanced powers that had taken their countries to war both in World War I and World War II. And basically, by virtue of the magnitude of the violence of those two conflicts, shattered the old world order and created a new world order, but nobody knew exactly what it was going to look like. So the U.S. crafted this concept of a world order. But in Europe, the idea was not to humble and humiliate Germany as it had been humbled and humiliated following its defeat after World War I, but to integrate all of these European powers together so as to avoid a World War III. And so there's military arrangements, there's diplomatic arrangements, there's economic arrangements, there's the latter stage of it, the free movement of people and capital, meaning the softer borders that existed between those countries. Now we're in 2018. You see a lot of centrifugal tendencies because of economic dislocation, economic suffering, Do you think this project is coming to an end?
I think that it is coming to an end in its existing form. I mean, you gave a very, very good summary of its history and of its origins in the early years of the Second World War and of its subsequent evolution. I think what is true to say about the European Union is two things. Firstly, I think there has been a degree of overreach. I think they moved much too fast after the 1990s when the Soviet Union fell with the three simultaneous projects that they tried to embark on. The British and the Americans wanted EU expansion into Eastern Europe to attach the former Soviet states, the former states that were aligned to the Soviet Union, into the EU. Germans wanted to focus on the reunification of Germany itself, and France wanted the single currency to anchor Germany to itself. Now, all those three things were done at one and the same time without anybody really thinking through the consequences. There was a great deal of euphoria at that time. There was an expectation that anything could be achieved. And the result is that we have an overreach and we have protests all over Europe against different aspects of what has happened. The British are not happy with the integration. The French are not happy with the economic policies that have followed from the introduction of the euro, which they advocated for, and the Germans are becoming increasingly uncertain about the way in which Eastern Europe was added on in the way that it was. So we have these problems. There is also a further problem, which touches back on the problem that on your analysis originally, which is that in some respects, the European Union, or rather the common market, the EEC, its various iterations, may have served to some extent its original purpose. Because if, and to the extent that it was intended to pacify tensions in Europe between Germany and France and other Western countries, other European countries, it is very difficult any longer to imagine any of these countries realistically going to war with themselves. And in fact, there is a case for saying that the European Union, by becoming attached to the global policies of the United States, which are perceived by many people as rather aggressive, is no longer an anchor for peace and stability in Europe. It is a source for tension in Europe and for stress in international relations, and it puts the whole international system at risk. Personally, what I would like to see, I think the European Union still has some attractive things. I mean, I like the fact, for example, that there is free movement within it, that people from different countries are able to move about. There are lots of good things that I would like to see preserved, but I think that it has to be looked at again, and people have to consider whether the present structure is fit for purpose. If I can just touch on a very quick point, there are some people, I was reading a very interesting book by Professor Kostas Lapavitsas of the School of Oriental and African Studies in London, who questions whether such a reform is even possible. But I would at least like to give it a try. I think a less grandiose structure, one that was able to take more, closer, allowed more room for people in Europe to breathe so that we do not have catastrophes like the ones we've seen in Greece and in Britain, and we do not have this imposition of neoliberal, ultra-free market economic policies, which the European Union has increasingly become the vehicle for imposing on the people of Europe.
One question that occurs to me is, and I thought it had been settled, and maybe it has been settled, and we just don't know it here, or I don't know it, but part of the earlier provisions of the free movement of people, meaning all citizens from any EU member nation could move to another member nation and reside there. They could find work there. They could set up a business there. And you have quite a number of people who had come to the UK, mostly from the East European countries. Those are countries that have a lower gross domestic national product, GNP, poorer countries. They came, they took jobs. The jobs were probably on the lower end of the pay scale. And then you had British citizens able to go, I don't know, to other places that would be enviable if you're British. Maybe they would be warmer places like Spain, for instance. Are those people's, and we're talking about a couple millions of people, I mean, are those people who have already made the move, are they grandfathered into any agreement or if there's no agreement? In other words, is their status clear or unclear?
It's not clear at all. If you're talking about the British situation, it's not clear at all. I mean, if there is, if we have a deal, even if we, if for example, Theresa May's deal were to be voted through by the British Parliament, then the rights of these people would be protected. If we have a situation where Britain crashes out of the European Union on the 29th of March without any kind of agreement at all, without even agreements on transitional arrangements, then we have total uncertainty about everything, because there are huge webs of agreements that tie Britain in with other European states as part of its membership of the European Union that can become unraveled. To give one famous example, I am not sure whether I can take my dogs, my two dogs, to Europe any longer after the 29th of March. Up to now, if I wanted to drive to Paris from London in my car with my dogs, I could do so. I'm not sure whether I'll be able to do so on the 29th of March. And if that applies to dogs, it certainly applies to people also.
You know, I even heard a British citizen recently on BBC in an interview, a young woman, mid-20s, let's say, and she was complaining about not being able to go to Euro Disney without a passport now. And she was, I mean, lamenting this. This is, I guess, very important to her. But it seems to me like these little issues that are actually not so little, going to Europe without a passport, not being able to take your dogs to the continent, these are issues that British citizens weren't thinking of when they voted for Brexit. They were thinking of these massive savings that they were purported to be in line for from the National Health Service by pulling out of the European Union, and that just simply wasn't true.
And for Americans, and before you answer, Alexander, we have 1 minute left. For Americans, think about if you were driving from New York to Pennsylvania or New York to Ohio, and you had to stop at customs. I mean, it's a big deal.
Right.
Go ahead, Alexander, 1 minute left.
Well, indeed, that is exactly right. I mean, I think people did not consider these things. It was all expressed on great overarching principles. There is a view, which I think is not, by the way, an invalid one, that, of course, a lot of the people who voted for Brexit came from the more socially and economically oppressed classes who do not travel much to Europe anyway because they cannot afford to. So there was also a class aspect about this. They were saying, we are excluded from the benefits of the Union. We want to take control of our lives. We do not want a political class in London which is interested in the wealthy middle classes and the rich. We want to hurt them in whatever way we can. Of course, they will also find, if this thing goes forward without a deal being done on the 29th of March, that they will also be hurt in many ways too. And of course, the nonsense about the National Health Service benefiting from this Brexit is, I think, now plain for all to see.
That was the voice of Alexander Makouris. Alexander joined us from London. He is the editor-in-chief of The Duran. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Today we continue our weekly series. It's every Tuesday. It's called False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. Daniel joins us from San Francisco. Daniel is a financial policy analyst. Daniel Sankey, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
Again, so many big issues. And I would say, John, in many ways, this segment is vital for all humans everywhere, because what happens to the economy?
Mm-hmm. It affects all of us. And I'll tell you the truth, in this segment and the Monday segment on technology, I learn more than in anything else that we do on this show.
I don't want to guess on the other segments.
Sorry.
You say that.
Sorry.
He was joking. But we do learn a lot. Daniel Sankey, let's start.
Yeah, I think really the big news this week, there's some other things too, is around China. You know, show has done a couple reports on the recent arrest by the CFO of Huawei, which made headlines. Really what we're starting to see is an unraveling of U.S.-China relations. I won't, you know, dig into the Huawei thing overly much because obviously it's been well covered. But really, you know, I think someone compared it to, you know, this would be like France arresting Jeff Bezos if on behalf of China, right? It's a huge deal. Huawei is a massive corporation providing tremendous amounts of smartphones, internet infrastructure, amongst other things. And this is, you know, this is a significant act of aggression. It's a hostage situation. The United States has decided to take a hostage. It's based on the pretext that China is in violation of trading with Iran, of Iranian sanctions, which, of course, it was allowed to trade with based on the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, the nuclear Iran deal, which the U.S. signed, agreed to, and now has decided to violate their treaty and punish other people for following the treaty that they signed with them. So it's absolutely, it's a significant uptick in aggression and a significant shift in it. What I wanted to talk about is what China has been doing. I don't want to necessarily say in response to the Huawei arrest, because I think it's in response to the overall souring of relations. I don't think it's necessarily just because their CFO was arrested. But, you know, the Wall Street Journal reported recently that the Chinese investors in real estate in the United States, which invest a tremendous amount of money, are starting to continue their trend of pulling back investments out of the United States real estate market. So it's a very popular market to invest in. U.S. real estate drives in a lot of foreign capital. Foreign capital is certainly not the majority of investments. The majority of investments come domestically, but it is significant. So, you know, the Wall Street Journal reports that in Q3, China dumped about $1 billion in U.S. real estate across the United States, which is a continuation of a trend. They've been continuing to dump it.
Let me just ask you about that. So there's different elements of that, just so we want to help the audience, again, understand some of that. So if the Chinese are selling real estate, Chinese investors are selling real estate, say in California, where you are, that means the demand on real estate starts to diminish, which means that the price or the cost of real estate will also go down. That's one of the effects. Now, for some people, that would be a good thing, right? Because the price of real estate in California is so high. Other people who are in the business will, you know, find it less helpful because they live off of and make profits from higher prices. So that's one element of the story. The other element of the story is from the Chinese point of view, not from the California point of view. It seems to me that real estate invested in the United States was an instrument for capital outflows from Chinese investors or Chinese corporations or rich Chinese people who are part of that sort of so-called free market in China. So the government, I think, in the deteriorating international atmosphere, which has threatened some of China's growth, and in fact, some of China's growth, while still greater, say, than the United States or Europe, has slowed somewhat. It's a way of signaling, the government is signaling these kind of investors, stop it, stop investing your capital in ways that advance Western countries' economies, keep that capital at home. And that capital may be deeply, profoundly needed, especially if there are economic hard times on the horizon.
Yes, that's exactly the case. The United States really has a global eye towards spreading its kind of global capitalist influence. And one of the ways it did that, it was it made it easy for foreign investors to invest their money in U.S. real estate, really at the expense of its own citizens who now were forced to compete with extremely wealthy people abroad, which they couldn't possibly hope to compete with. Many of them would purchase this real estate as an investment. In other words, they wouldn't live there. In fact, a lot of them would simply park their money there and walk away. It was also a great way to stay out of reach of Chinese taxes and regulations because your real estate is now in another company. Another country. So it's hard for Chinese authorities to seize property in the United States. So there was a lot of advantages, and the U.S. was very willing to cause ballooning, you know, asset prices here because ultimately it benefited a lot of very wealthy people domestically, all these, you know, hedge funds and equity firms that invest in real estate and pump up the prices till it's almost unaffordable. So What we're seeing now, though, China has allowed this to happen to a degree because it has been allowed to participate in the overall kind of global capitalist market that the United States has created. It's allowed to have built up a middle class by trading with the U.S., by having the U.S. export a lot of its operations to China. And now we're seeing a reversal of that, because what we're seeing is Chinese regulators stepping in and starting to say, hey, we don't want this capital outflow anymore. We're stepping in and putting in regulations, we're enforcing regulations to reduce the amount of money flowing out of China into the United States real estate and causing U.S. or causing Chinese investors to pull it back. So it has a lot of different effects, right? One of them is lower property values, which is great for renters and for people who are thinking of buying. Really, you know, it benefits a ton of people, especially in urban areas. But what it shows is how this is one of the ways China can kind of hit back against corporate Wall Street and kind of U.S. capitalist interest is by making it harder for its people to put money into those markets, which is what we're seeing now. And we're continuing to see that retreat. It also could signal that Chinese investors feel that they are hitting the top of a bubble and that there's a real estate bubble right now that's going to burst soon. And so they're starting to pull out the money before it starts collapsing down. And I think there's both of those things in this. There's the trade war, which is aggravating it. And there's also their speculation. Finally, they're seeing what the U.S. will do to even, you know, the heights of their economic elite, right, the CFO of Huawei. And they're worried about their own investments in the U.S. What if the U.S. starts seizing their property here? What if the U.S. starts accusing them of sanctions and there are wealthy people in China that then are going to get their property stolen here, essentially, under the guise of sanctions? So they want to pull their money out and put it somewhere a little safer where it's clear the administration is extremely antagonistic towards China. So this is a really important dynamic, and it influences a lot of different things.
Yeah, Daniel Sankey is our guest. Daniel is a financial policy analyst. We talk to Daniel every Tuesday in this segment called False Profits, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. You're listening to Loud and Clear. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. at 105.5 FM and at 1390 AM. You can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, 4 to 6 p.m. at SputnikNews.com, and you can subscribe to the show as a podcast at iTunes Radio, iHeartRadio. You can listen to it at Spotify or at Spreaker. That's like speaker, but with an extra R. Daniel Sankey, let's go on to the next story.
Yeah, so in the vein of discussing China, a Chinese court recently ruled against Apple and ordered it to stop selling older iPhone models because basically it found in favor of a company called Qualcomm, which I'm sure some of us have heard of. Qualcomm was accusing Apple of infringing on its copyright patents that it had over certain microchips that Apple was using in its older model phones. So Apple and Qualcomm had been fighting back and forth about it. Apple says no infringement. Qualcomm says big infringement. In the end, the Chinese court found in favor of Qualcomm, which means that Apple was forced to stop selling certain older phones. And so their newest devices, the XS and the XS Max and the XR, are all okay, but it is barring import and sales of the X, the 8, the 7, and the 6 models, which is still, you know, a substantial amount of profit for Apple. So what this means is it's a big win for Qualcomm, and it also cuts Apple out of the Chinese market, except for their very new models. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, the Chinese court was, you know, following some kind of dictate from the higher up to fight against Apple. But in the overall souring of relations of the United States and China, we can see why this move makes sense, where China is effectively saying we can make it very hard to do business in our country. And over the last 30, 40 years, United States commerce has become so entwined in China that it's not just easy to pick up and move on. And in this case, it's not even about picking up and moving on. It's about being able to sell to the Chinese, who, over the incredible economic growth they've seen over the last 30, 40 years, have a really strong middle class. There's a lot of upward mobility, and people can actually afford these smartphones. So what China is doing is cutting Apple out of the market and making it a lot harder to do business. This is a continuing sign of how things are souring. China is not this kind of weak, you know, paper tiger that is just completely at the beck and call of the United States. They've grown into a real economic power, and they're willing to use it to protect their people and to protect their interests. So it's important that we put in that context, because China has a lot of influence that it can use to hit back against the U.S. as these various totally unwarranted aggression comes out of the United States. And this is one example of it. So I expect to see more things like that, as China can certainly take action against other U.S. companies that sell smartphones or technology there, such as Google, for example. And that probably Amazon might have a presence there as well. And it has the power to do that. And this is a big market that tech companies really want access to, because, you know, there's over 1 billion people in China and many of them can afford their products. And so what we're seeing is this is a continuing souring of relations as China is starting to push back. And really, at the end of the day, what it does is it, you know, increases prices for your average people here in the U.S. as different companies are pushed out of other markets and forced to try to make profit elsewhere. And of course, they'll try to do it in markets they can, that they are allowed to do business in, such as the United States. So you can expect that they'll try to squeeze more profit out over here to make up for profits lost abroad.
That was the voice of Daniel Sankey. We talk to Daniel every Tuesday in this segment called False Profits, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism. We're going to be joined now in studio by Walter Smolarek. He is a Sputnik News analyst and a producer of this show, Loud and Clear. Walter, welcome.
Happy to be here.
I know you, Walter, have also been following what's happening with Huawei, the Chinese technology company, one of the biggest in the world, and their chief financial officer still in jail after being arrested on December 1st in Canada by the Canadian authorities at the request of the United States. We're going to have another segment where we're in the second hour where we're going to talk in detail again, a shorter segment, but in detail about what this arrest means or what it might portend. But I want to stay with it for another minute or two. It seems to me that there are different competing interests here. We have the U.S. government representing the government and the power of the state, meaning the power to impose sanctions, the power to arrest people. And at the same time, you have American businesses who believe that the state should be and the government should be representing them. They have their own distinctive interest. They may agree in general, well, we don't want, you know, in 75 years, China to take the lead over the United States in technology. But, you know, CEOs of these corporations are not thinking about what's going on in 75 years or in 75 months. They're thinking about what's going to happen in the next 90 days. They're thinking about the quarter. They're thinking about what can they do to maximize profit, because investors are going to look at the end of every quarter. Are you maximizing profits? Am I getting the maximum return on my investment? Because if I'm not, I'm going to go to another company because I'm investing money not for this or that reason. The only reason is because I want to make more money. So we have a contradictory phenomena right now. The American government that's supposedly representing American businesses is carrying out a geopolitical, geostrategic struggle against China that will hurt some sectors of American business. What do you think?
Yeah, it's a very interesting dynamic. And I mean, I think it explains basically why there is a state, why there is a government in a society like the United States, is because, you know, you're absolutely right. The only thing that a CEO cares about, and it's his fiduciary duty, right, to really only care about, is what the profits are like this quarter, you know, because there's a board of directors that the CEO has to answer to. They have to, you know, justify their continued leadership of the company. When you have all these different, very, very narrowly interested capitalists of business leaders who, you know, are just looking out for their own sectoral interests, it makes it much more difficult. It makes it impossible, in fact, to make these long-term geopolitical and political moves to guarantee the dominance of U.S. corporations writ large over the world, really, is their goal. And so that's why you have to have a government to do that for them, to make that sort of executive, to have that executive decision-making function. You know, the U.S. electoral system also adds another layer of complication, I think, because some of the sectors of the economy that are particularly hurt by the tariffs, as opposed to helped by the tariffs, are in politically sensitive states. You know, the agricultural industry primarily. You know, these are states where Donald Trump is very popular. He would like to continue to be popular in those states, and some of them, you know, might be in play in the 2020 election.
That was the voice of Walter Smolarek, Sputnik News analyst and a producer of this show, Loud and Clear. We're also talking with Daniel Sankey. We talk to Daniel every week about the big economic issues, and sometimes these economic issues are not purely economic. They overlap with geostrategic policies and strategies by governments. So we're talking about right now the big picture in terms of the continued imprisonment of Huawei CFO, Chief Financial Officer in Canada. Still no bail. Amazing. And at the same time that this takes place in the context of not only a trade war, but the possibility of a trade war truce. Because at the moment that the CFO was arrested, that day, December 1st, Donald Trump was actually meeting with Xi Jinping when they were both at the G20 meeting in Buenos Aires, Argentina. And after that, remember, Donald Trump came out and said, we had a great meeting. It's a great deal. It's going to be good for China. It's going to be good for Americans, especially good for American agriculture. And he put it in all caps, of course, because he's the president and he uses Twitter in all caps. And then the next day, the stock market rose. And then the next day, he announced that Robert Lighthizer, who's a hardline anti-China hawk, would lead the negotiations, the 90-day negotiation with China. He said it was going to be a tough negotiations, or Lighthizer did. And so then the stock market plunged. And it's been volatile. It's gone up and down, but mainly down, Daniel. Earlier today, China agreed to reduce tariffs on U.S. autos to 15%, down from 40% currently, during a phone call with U.S. officials that opened the latest round of trade talks aimed, they say, at settling the trade dispute between these two major world powers. This took place in a discussion between the Chinese vice premier and Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin and U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer. Now, the Chinese had put these high tariffs on autos, the 40%, in retaliation to Donald Trump's earlier tariffs. The question to you, Daniel, is this. Is this largely symbolic on China's part regarding auto tariffs, or is this really something of substance? Are the Chinese really doing something more than simply giving Donald Trump and his negotiating team talking points so that they can say they brought home the bacon?
Yeah, I think that there is a little act of symbolism. So one thing that China is very good at is helping the United States save face and make it look like we're being very strong and tough when in fact we're not. China is very willing to allow us to look like the strong guy if they get what they need. So by reducing the tariffs, it allows Trump and Lighthizer to look like they're real tough and they fought hard and they got China to do some things. But the truth is that tariff decrease is not going to impact things overly dramatically given the flow of trade. That's not exactly how it works where U.S. autos are being exported to China for sale. That's not a huge market for them. So while it did impose that tariff as a way of retaliating and trying to take back some control, it wasn't like it was some kind of serious dramatic impact to General Motors or something like that, where now they're cut out of this huge Chinese market that they were into. So I think it's kind of a face-saving gesture to help the U.S. try to stay strong. I think China is still playing a very conservative, very patient approach in spite of, you know, one of their powerful business class getting arrested. I question it. I'm not sure if the strategy is the right one. We'll see how China plays it out. I do think, though, this destroys the narrative which says, China's this big, bad, mean, dangerous empire that's going to beat up the U.S. if we're not careful and we have to fight them hard, hard, hard. It's just simply not true. That's absolutely not the dynamic between China and the U.S. Our military is insanely bigger. Our economy is much bigger as well. We're absolutely the bullies in this situation and are taking advantage of them. I'm not sure, though, if China is playing a role, though. This administration has shown that it is not interested in any kind of internal consistency. It is not interested in remembering favors given to it in the past as a way of influencing what it does today. It's not interested in maintaining relationships. It's really incredibly chaotic. And I think we spend a lot of time on this show and others trying to understand what's Donald Trump thinking and what's the logic and the reason behind this. And I think what we've seen in this administration is that's not the point. The point is that they are happy to change their entire perspective and strategy overnight if it's going to get them what they think they want. So I think China would be a mistake to think that somehow if it plays really nice to the U.S. and smiles and genuflex and bows, that Trump's going to leave it alone. I think this is the new kind of aggression that we're going to see, at least under this administration and probably others, that China will have to contend with. And I think it needs to start taking that seriously and thinking about how it's really going to try to address these things rather than just sort of these kind of gestures towards the U.S. to make us feel strong.
Daniel Sankey, let's go on to another story. Let's go on about pay in America. Nothing is more important to U.S. workers than these questions. Do I have a job? Is the job secure? Am I making enough money to keep up with inflation? Because it is increasing. And do I have enough money to make some savings? Because eventually, with this system, such as it is, I'm going to have medical bills that I can't pay, or my kids are going to want to go to college and they're not going to be able to afford it and they're not going to get enough in scholarship or financial aid. So the question of pay is all important to U.S. workers, as it is to workers everywhere. I'm looking at a story that you sent to us about the biggest pay raise on Wall Street. Talk about that story.
Yeah, I think this is really important. So the idea, or at least in under capitalist America, is that the people who contribute the most to society, the people that do the best and the most valuable work, get the most money. And if you're not getting paid much, it's because your work doesn't matter. And what this article is about how derivatives traders on Wall Street received the biggest bonuses this year. Most of them in the higher ranks make about $3 million a year. That's a few hundred thousand dollars more than a year ago, according to the Wall Street Journal. And that's just their salary. That's not to say their investments, which make them much more than $3 million. So $3 million is actually kind of the low end of what they're taking home. What is a derivatives trader? I think I want to talk about that because we talk about the value that work brings to society. So a derivative is a made-up number that is affiliated with a real thing. So specifically, you take oranges and you could have stock in a company that produces oranges. And if they make a lot of money off oranges, the stock goes up. And if they don't make any money off oranges, the stock goes down. Derivatives are on top of that. And derivatives allow you to bet against the price of oranges so that if they go down, your derivatives actually make money, and the reverse. It sounds complicated because it is complicated. I think that during the 2008 crisis, Alan Greenspan was saying that, you know, math PhDs couldn't understand some of the derivatives that were going on in the housing market. They can get extremely complex and have a whole lot of clauses and mathematical variants in them. But the point being is these derivatives traders betting against the success of other companies, betting against the profitability of them, made a tremendous amount of money, and they make it off of volatility. As prices in the market jump around, and believe me, they've been jumping around a lot lately, derivatives traders actually make money as opposed to traditional investors who lose money. And so this is their contribution to society, is to bet against people making money using complex mathematics and then taking their money when they lose it. It's really just a very complex form of gambling. And what it turns out is these gamblers did a very good job this last quarter. And they were helped a lot by the volatility in the trade war. So it turns out the trade war actually helped these people. Economic instability helped them make money. And then in return, they got to have, you know, between $3 and $2.5 million a year in salary. And that's just salary, not counting their investments, which made many, many millions more. So I think we need to talk a little bit when we talk about pay and what people need to take home to survive. Is people betting and gambling against others' profitability a contribution that really benefits society? Does it help people? Is it like a teacher that teaches us how to add or read or things like that? Is it like a sanitation worker, which keeps our streets clean and allows us to walk around with minimum of disease and pleasant surroundings? Well, what it currently says in our society is that people that gamble this way are somehow paid more and are more valuable than people who provide services and goods that we actually need to survive and to have comfortable and healthy lives.
Daniel, we only have about 3 minutes left. Let's go on. Harvard quietly amasses California vineyards and the water underneath. I thought Harvard was an educational institution.
Yeah, I thought so too. So what this means is Harvard has a massive endowment. We're talking billions of dollars. It's bigger than most hedge funds. Harvard is an investment firm that dwarfs many other investment firms. It's not just the school that's interested in enlightening us. And what Harvard has decided to start doing is buying up a lot of the water in California, specifically those in Napa and that feed the wine industry. And what it's betting on is climate change. It's betting that climate change is going to continue to spiral in this direction and that water will become more and more scarce. And when it becomes scarce, it's going to become more and more valuable. So what this, you know, distinguished institution of education has decided to do is buy water in hopes that people will undergo severe climate change so that it can jack up the prices on water, which will force people to buy because, of course, you'll buy water. You can't live without it. You'll do whatever it takes to get water. So what it's doing is gambling against climate change and gambling against human beings in hoping that it can profit off of their thirst and their starvation as climate change becomes more aggressive. And this is what the Harvard investment fund has decided to do. And so far, according to the report in the Wall Street Journal, they've been making a lot of money since 2012 when they started doing this, and they anticipate making a lot more as they're accelerating their investments. So this is, this is what education is in the United States. It's essentially a hedge fund using climate change to profit off of people.
90 seconds left, Daniel. You're in California. I'm looking at a Wall Street Journal article from today. Economic damage from California fires spreads further than blazes. Chico businesses lose workers with nowhere to live, zero apartments available to rent. The California city of Chico escaped the wrath of last month's campfire that destroyed communities 15 miles to the east, but now it's facing the blazes' economic fallout. A major part of Chico's workforce, including contractors, hospital staff, and employees of the city's California State University branch, lived in or near the town of Paradise, and that has been completely destroyed. Really something. Go ahead. 1 minute left.
I mean, imagine in Paradise, okay, the fire's out, and maybe your house didn't get burned, or maybe your shop didn't get burned, right? Maybe you were the lucky part of them. But what are you going to open your doors to? There's no one there. Everyone is forced out of the community. So even if you're were lucky and your structure wasn't burned down, you're economically bankrupt. Who can live there? All the stores are closed because there's not enough people to buy the food. So you can't get food or basic things. The infrastructure is ruined. So it really totally annihilates that community. And then the surrounding community is what depended on it to survive, like as you're describing. So this has huge downstream effects. It's not just burning down houses and it's not just insurance companies, although it certainly is that. You're going to see the economic downturn from the lack of these places, and it's going to impact the people who now have no homes, and many people who will shortly have no homes because of the local economy being devastated. So this is a huge cost of climate change. This is what climate change is going to cost us, and this is just a micro amount compared to what could happen potentially in the future. I think we really need to pay attention to that as we start asking ourselves, what is this worth and what is its value? Is it really worth derivatives traders making $3 million a year if it means entire cities go up in smoke? And I think the answer to that is pretty clear.
That's the voice of Daniel Sankey. Daniel joins us here on Loud and Clear every Tuesday in a segment called False Profits, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism. Daniel will be back with us next Tuesday. Be sure to stay tuned to Loud and Clear after a short break. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.